Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State. The best outcomes for treating cancer come from early detection. The James Cancer Diagnostic Center is designed to provide rapid evaluation and a clear diagnosis to those who suspect they have cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/diagnosticcenter.
Welcome to the All Sides Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we catch up on political news of last week and preview the week ahead. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Joining me on the roundtable this week, we have Karen Kassler, Bureau Chief for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Welcome back, Karen.
Hey, good morning.
And from Hannah News Service, Shane Stegmiller. Welcome back, Shane.
Hello. Happy Groundhog Day.
Oh, it is. That's right. And with us, we have Susan Tebben, reporter for the Ohio Capital Journal. Welcome, Susan.
Hi, thank you.
Did the groundhog see a shadow? I don't even know.
Yes.
Yes.
Oh. Yeah, but I believe, I know Benny the Bass out in Buckeye Lake did not, so I'm going to go with that. I can't remember about Buckeye Chuck. I think he may have not seen a shadow.
I'm not sure. I know.
I think we could get someone to Google that real quick for us. There we go. Yeah, Punxsutawney Phil is the groundhog, though,
and
right?
And he did see his shadow.
And he did see a shadow, which means six more weeks of winter.
Oh, he'll never come back.
All right. We'll make it. We'll find out about Buckeye Chuck here in a minute. Well, who's the Bass? I'm sorry. I don't know.
Benny the Bass. Buckeye Lake.
This is a new one on me. Well, all right. I'll look him up later.
All right. Check him out.
In more serious news, today is the day that, tomorrow is the day that thousands of Haitians in Ohio are expected to lose their legal status as their temporary protected status is set to expire. Governor DeWine last week said to prepare for a possible ICE surge in Springfield, heightening concerns following the deaths of Renee Good and Alex Preddy in Minneapolis. Faith leaders from across the U.S. will gather this morning to pray and to call for an extension of the protected status. Here is Springfield Mayor Rob Rue speaking to reporters last week.
We would hope that federal agents would treat our residents with dignity and respect, and that I would hope that they would reveal their faces as other law officers have to.
Karen, Springfield's the home of a sizable Haitian population. City commissioners are urging federal agents to remove their masks and carry ID if they do come to the city. Does a city official like the city of Springfield have the authority to say anything about federal agents? Do you know?
No, they don't have the authority to order those agents to do anything. They've asked. And we've got about 12 to 15,000 Haitians in Springfield. It's unknown how many of those have TPS. And right now, TPS is still being discussed in court. Mm-hmm. So there is a possibility that status could be extended or something could happen here. But I thought DeWine's comments to my colleague Sarah Donaldson last week about this were interesting. He said that he's gotten mixed signals from the federal government about whether there will be a surge of ICE agents in Springfield. And he also said it would be a mistake for the federal government to take that legal status away. So this is some of the strongest language we've heard from him on that. He's often said that he thinks that TPS was important for Haitians who are legally here in Ohio, working in a lot of the businesses in the Springfield area. But this is pretty direct language, I think, especially from him at this time.
Yeah. And Susan or Shane, what are we hearing from other members of the State House? Is it just Governor DeWine speaking out about this? Has anyone else said anything?
Mainly Governor DeWine. You've mm-hmm. gotten some comments from various members of the congressional delegation. Joyce Beatty's made some comments about it. Bernie Moreno's on the record saying some of the Haitians with the TPS should have probably already self-deported by now. So you're seeing it more on the federal level. There are some state house members who say it, but it's your average legislator, and they're not breaking through the amount of other voices coming through at the moment.
Yeah, the Clark County Sheriff, his name's Chris Clark, said his agency does not have an immigration-specific policy, but his deputies do have the authority to enforce overstays, or his deputies do not have the authority to enforce overstays on temporary protected status. So this would be a federal issue. He's saying that the county is not involved in overstays on TPS. Right. Does that make sense? All right. So we also know that there's a group of faith leaders from across the country that are gathering in Springfield this morning. They're going to pray. They're going to call for an extension of the temporary protected status. I'm not sure, will that have any influence, or do you think that it's just a nice show of will, Susan?
I mean, it's certainly a good show of will. Obviously, we've had plenty of stories. My colleague Megan Henry has covered a lot of what Springfield is and the identities of these people that are just trying to work and lead their lives in Springfield. And it does, I'm sure for those that live there, it's a good show that they do have support, and it's not just this overwhelming, you know, national headlines of what's happening and the rhetoric that comes from the federal side. So, I would see that as sort of an optimistic thing for them. Whether or not it has any sort of impact on the other side, I'm not sure.
And Karen, the temporary protected status has been extended because President Trump announced he was going to take it away, but it has been extended twice now since Trump took office. Do I have that right? I think it was August and last February, maybe.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting to note that as of July, the U.S. Department of State had heavily advised against traveling to Haiti. Mm-hmm. I mean, DeWine has said several times that Haiti is a dangerous place, that it has not gotten better. The idea that somehow the nation is secure and safe enough that people could go back to it, he finds that to be untrue. So I think that that's an important element here that could play a role perhaps in the court discussions about this. But I think this is a really fluid situation right now. I know there's a lot of worry, though. I mean, you see the faith leaders who've been out there, gosh, for months on this. Mm-hmm. And I mean, Senator Bernie Moreno is correct in that we've all known that this date was coming. And he said that maybe the need for ICE agents wouldn't be as great because of the self-deportation that people should have done, according to him. But certainly there are people in the community who have been worried about this date coming for quite a long time and have been trying to get out there, trying to get ahead of this, trying to see what they can do to bring some attention to this.
The Democratic Congresswoman Joyce Beatty is among lawmakers who signed on to legislation calling for the impeachment of Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem. And then she had a closed-door roundtable about ICE last week, and Beatty talked about the lack of training that these federal agents receive. Here's a portion of her remarks.
If you're going to wear a jacket that says police officer, then you ought to be like our great police officers in this community. You ought to have de-escalation training. You ought to have a body camera. You have to be held accountable.
And then, Karen, your colleague Sarah Donaldson had an interview with Republican Senator Bernie Moreno that you just alluded to. Here's some audio of what he told her.
The temporary protective status was going to end. It was never intended to be permanent. It was always temporary. Everybody always knew the date. So we shouldn't have to surge a force in there to forcibly deport people who've known for a long time that they have to do that on their own.
Yeah. So, Karen, what you're saying is he went on to say more in whenever he was talking with Sarah. He said that they should be self-deporting. What did he mean by that? They knew it was temporary, so they should just leave?
Well, I believe with TPS and maybe some other statuses, if you voluntarily leave, there's some money involved and there's no penalty to leave. And so that's what he's been saying, is that if these folks knew that this deadline was coming, they should have voluntarily left. But where do you go? I mean, the question has been raised that, well, they can go anywhere. If they don't want to go to Haiti, they can go anywhere else. But where do you go? And so you've got people who are on TPS from Haiti who have been in this country for many years. They have children who are American citizens because they were born here. Then where do those people go? And what happens to their families, the economy in Springfield? That's another thing that DeWine has been concerned about with so many. If you end up with thousands of people leaving the workforce all at once, essentially, that does have an impact on the businesses who have said they hired these folks because they came to work, they could pass drug tests, all that sort of thing.
You're listening to All Sides in the Weekly Reporter Roundtable on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking with Karen Kassler from the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau and Shane Stegmiller from Hannah News Service and Susan Tebben from the Ohio Capital Journal. Susan, there was a call last Friday for Americans to protest the funding of ICE by not going to work, school, or shopping. A lot of people weren't going to school because of all the snow last week anyway. And then there was also a protest organized at the State House. Do we know if that coordinated effort really amounted to anything, not shopping on last Friday?
Yeah, I'm not sure if it amounted to anything. I mean, certainly any movement is something to be said. But, you know, we have already seen so much, you know, outspokenness about how people feel about immigration agents, you know, going into Minnesota and Operation Buckeye and all that stuff. So I think it's just sort of a piling on of what we've already seen, which is, you know, a general disdain of the actions that have been happening. So, you know, these things are, you know, in addition to what we've already seen, and I'm sure we'll see more of that as far as a boycott. That's hard to, it's hard to quantify whether those, you know, consumer boycotts will do anything, but it's certainly interesting to see those happening and see, you know, what the impact people do think that those will have.
And Shane, I'm not sure if you were at the State House on Friday when this protest happened, or if anyone was.
I was,
you
yes.
were, okay, was it very large? I mean, it was very cold.
It was a good size, a couple hundred people. Mm-hmm. And considering how cold it was, and these folks stayed there for more than 2 hours, which was, you know, something to note, I think. And, you know, daytime protests, I think, are tough because, you know, people are working and they're in school and that sort of thing. So a protest at 3 o'clock on a Friday afternoon, kind of quickly called together, turning out a couple hundred people, I think, is interesting to note.
And Shane, can you give us a little bit more of a reminder of why Springfield ended up being the home to so many Haitians? Karen talked a little bit about DeWine's public support of the community there, but can you give us a little bit more on that?
It's an issue I haven't covered as much. I know there was kind of a lure there because there were a lot of open jobs, and with all these new immigrants looking for jobs, you know, their factories were looking for people. They were having trouble hiring, especially people who, you know, who are going to show up to work, who didn't have drug issues or addiction issues. And so a lot of Haitians were lured to the community to help fill some of these jobs. You'll recall back in the 2024 election that it became kind of ground zero for the immigration debate. During the debate, you know, you had President Trump saying they're eating the cats and dogs in Springfield, and we had that whole discussion coming. When the Trump administration came in, they made it clear that that was going to be one of the places they were going to look on the immigration policy to, you know, end the protective status. I believe there's about 100,000 Haitians across the country with TPS currently.
And it's tough to track that, I think. But, I mean, for TPS status, TPS goes back for some of these folks to 2010 because there was an earthquake in Haiti that really started some of this. And so, you know, Trump was going to cancel TPS in his first administration. And so this has been something. And I mean, you've even heard Bernie Marino when he was running saying he supported the end of TPS for Haitians. So this has been a while coming. And, you know, I'm wondering not only in Springfield, but also there's a significant population of Haitians in Columbus. So, you know, there's another thing to look at. And when you start talking about surging ICE, could it be in Columbus, too? Because not only do you have Haitians here, but you also have a significant Somali population, which has borne the brunt of an awful lot of unfounded allegations, just like the Haitians in Springfield with those racist and untrue allegations about eating pets and that sort of thing. So I think that there's worry not only in Springfield, but also here in Columbus a little bit, too.
And if you'll recall, the governor, DeWine, does have ties to this population. His family has funded a school in Haiti. And his wife has been down there many, many times. So he's very aware of the situation down there.
And from what I've observed in, you know, the coverage and what's been said about it, it's not about, you know, coming up with a bunch of crimes that this population has done. It's not about them having acted any certain way. It's just this status. So if they're working there and they're doing what they're doing, and they have kids and they've had the status, it doesn't seem like there's any accusations that they are, you know, running rampant in Springfield doing anything other than trying to live their lives.
I think it got a huge spotlight on it, though, because there were so many Haitians that moved to the community. And when you have a community of, what, 40 to 45,000 people, and then suddenly you get 10 to 15,000 Haitians, there's going to be a strain on services in the area. And that's what happened.
And just to end on before we take the break, Karen, you wrote about some immigration-related bills at the Ohio State House. I know that they're not very far along in the process, but especially since I think some sessions were canceled last week because of the snowstorm. But what has been introduced so far? What are lawmakers trying to do?
We've got several bills that specifically, there's only so much that state lawmakers can do when it comes to immigration policy. And so you've got several Republican-backed bills that would, for instance, require state and local officials to cooperate with federal authorities and, you know, kind of aiming at sanctuary cities. And, and though Ohio has no official sanctuary cities, there are cities that, like Columbus, that have passed ordinances that say we're not going to cooperate with federal authorities here. You've also got a bill that would require hospitals and schools to report on the immigration status of students and patients, which has some concern there. There's another bill that would add a person's immigration status to the factors to be considered at a sentencing or an arraignment. So there are these bills that are kind of sitting out there. Most have only had one hearing, but if immigration continues to be a major topic of conversation during this election year, I could expect that these bills would at least get discussed, maybe not move, but maybe they will.
All right. Well, we will see how this shapes up with the election year. Coming up, we are going to talk about the aftermath of last week's winter storm, and we're going to get an update on health care coverage in Ohio and beyond. That is when the Reporter Roundtable from All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube. But what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.
You're listening to All Sides and the Weekly Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we talk all things Ohio politics. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. And with us, we have, from the Hannah News Service, Shane Stegmiller, Susan Tebben, a reporter for the Ohio Capital Journal, and Karen Kassler, bureau chief for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Ohioans are still dealing with the aftermath of last week's winter storm that dumped a foot of snow in many places. Many schools were out all week last week. My kids went back to school today. Woo! Snow removal is taking days. Some sidewalks are still snow covered. Some residents are dealing with burst pipes. The city of Columbus is dealing with burst pipes as well. Shane, you reported on some salt shortages that impacted some communities. What did you learn there?
So this is mainly a lot of them up in Northeast Ohio. And it's a combination of you have a worst winter than maybe many expected. And then also the supplier, which is Cargill's the supplier for a lot of the communities and for the state, they were a little behind on getting some of their shipments to some of the different communities from what I understand. So ahead of that huge storm that we just had last weekend, some of the communities were sweating it. The state and some of the other huge roads like the Turnpike and that, they seem to think they're going to be pretty good for the rest of the winter. Cargill says it's still shipping its salt and it expects to fulfill all of the orders. The question might be if we keep having storms like we've been having, whether or not it's going to get a little dicey by the time we get to the end of the season. Everybody seems pretty confident right now that they're going to have enough, though.
I learned that because it was so cold, certain types of salt don't work and they need a special blend. Do you know if the special blend was available or?
That I do not know about, but I have heard that, yes. And some of these Northeast Ohio communities, you know, it's been a bad winter here in Central Ohio. They've been getting hit. They always get hit with the lake effect snow and they've been getting hit with a lot more.
I know it's hard for me to imagine up there that they would run out of salt because they should have the most.
Well, and they've got the salt mine essentially is right there. But this has been a tough winter. And when I was talking to Matt Bruning from the Ohio Department of Transportation about this, he was reminding me that there were a lot of tons of salt used last year too, which I don't know about you, but I tend to forget what last winter is like when confronted with something like this. But yeah, there the salt, Shane's right that the salt, there's optimism that salt will continue, that we'll be able to have enough salt to get to the end of the year. But also, there's a concern about plows. There have been 49 crashes involving snow plows just from ODOT. So that's, you know, something to worry about, especially since some of the roads still, there's a little bit of snow still on the sides, and you have to be careful.
Mm. People are forgetting how to drive in the snow, or they're not following the level three. I don't know. Yeah.
Well, and the Ohio State Highway Patrol has said, reminds everybody that there is a move over law in Ohio. There's a move over law in every state, but Ohio's move over law is specifically targeted toward basically anything with flashing lights. So you've got police and sheriffs, but you've also got tow trucks and garbage trucks and snow plows. You need to move over and give them room to work. So that's maybe people aren't. And I know it's hard, you know, when you're out there right as the snow plow is in front of you and you're trying to follow them because that's the way you're going. So it's just, you got to give them plenty of room, though.
I feel like this all ties back to our lack of driver's education then, maybe. Maybe that's what Governor DeWine would say.
Everybody just loses their darn minds, too, whenever we get some weather not to what everybody's used to.
Yeah.
You probably need a recertification every 5 years or something.
You should have to take your driver's test in the snow. In a tiny Honda Civic. And see good luck if you make it. All right. Will we ever know the cost of cleanup? Do these big storms cost more money? I mean, they have to, right, for the state? Yeah. I mean,
you got to think that not only are you paying for all the salt, but you have to pay for man hours. These drivers are working 12-hour shifts at points. They're going to be getting overtime, as they should be, because it's pretty important. And, I mean, it's going to take a few days to dig out from some of this.
So. Yeah, it must be that we have a more mild winter and they don't have to spend as much money and then they have to spend more. I mean, I see every winter's different.
Yeah, plus I imagine the long-term effects of we don't even know what's going on with the snow and it's frozen. And so when it starts to melt, we'll have issues with that and then find out what's going on underneath, if it's damaged any roofs or whatever stuff. You have
break
to think
some
about that.
Pipes.
Right.
And that's another element here. There are parts of the state that are already prone to flooding every spring, and then that's on top of that. But because Matt Bruning at ODOT is so great with numbers, I've got some numbers here. 636,720 tons of salt already used and 338,686 tons available. So there's about half of what we've already used is still available, and hopefully we won't need it. Hopefully this is...
It's only the beginning of February, though.
I know.
There's a lot of... I mean, and according to the groundhog, we have 6 more weeks of winter.
And he told me that they're nearing their 10-year average on salt usage for this season, and it's only February 1st.
And this stuff's not going to melt till June, so...
All right. Moving on to health care. We're beginning to see some of the effects of the Affordable Care Act subsidies going away. More Ohioans are opting out of coverage. Can someone remind us about these subsidies? Because this was the big issue that caused the government shutdown last fall. So what are these subsidies and what went away?
I can. The subsidies themselves, it's kind of like a tax credit subsidy. So when you sign up for the Affordable Care Act, you get these, you get a certain price, and then these subsidies are on top of that. So basically these losing these subsidies mean you're going to be paying more like the original price of what it was going to be on the Affordable Care Act. So in some cases, that means we're doubling the prices that people are paying, and it's making it very unaffordable for a lot of people and making people already, because earlier this year, into last year, was the deadline for signing up. That means people were deciding not to, which is going to up our uninsured rate in Ohio, which advocates say is going to impact our, you know, long-term outcomes as far as health generally in Ohio.
And Karen, your colleague Joe Ingles interviewed Joanne Pickerell, the state lead for Protect Our Care. And Joanne talked about a Central Ohio family who lost their subsidy and is trying to figure out what to do. Here's what she said.
and now their monthly premium is more than their mortgage payment, and their deductible is $17,000. And as you can imagine, that's pretty stressful for them.
Do we know how typical that experience is, Joanne Pickrell, describing them having such a high deductible? Is that...
Well, about there are estimates that about 20% of Ohioans who got health insurance through the ACA are in this position here, maybe not as extreme, maybe worse. I mean, this is one story that we know about. So it's about 105,000 Ohioans have dropped their coverage because of this. And there's been a lot of discussion in Congress about how to deal with this. It was a key part of the federal government shutdown, the longest shutdown in history, and it still is out there. And so I don't know that there's been any sort of permanent resolution discussed that would allow these folks to go back to the levels they were at or give them some help. But, I mean, Susan's right that we're going to end up with a lot of people who are uninsured by their choice, but also because it was completely unaffordable.
Yeah, we've seen about a 21% drop in enrollment as of the end of January, according to the federal numbers.
You said 21%?
21%, mm-hmm. Yeah.
We've been talking about a lot of national issues on the roundtable because the Trump administration has made decisions that impact states and their budgets. But, Susan, there was a related health matter from the Trump administration, involving rural health, the Rural Health Transformation Program. Mm-hmm. Trump signed that into law in 2025, and it awarded Ohio $202 million. Do I have that right?
Right.
Okay. So what is this supposed to do, the Rural Health Transformation Program, and Ohio's portion?
Right. So this was kind of a response, it was a response to the cuts that were made in the federal budget. Mm-hmm. So in Ohio, we saw $33 million in Medicaid cuts that are coming over the next decade. So this was sort of a look at nationally, how do we account for, say, rural hospitals that are going to be losing funds from Medicaid? They have a lot of Medicaid patients, and so cutting those Medicaid funds means they're going to lose a lot of patients. Rural hospitals don't have a lot of margin when it comes to how they make their money. So, and not having these rural hospitals, certainly in Ohio, means a lot of people will have to access care in, you know, going hours to be able to access care. And, you know, if you have an emergency situation, you don't necessarily have hours to drive somewhere. So this Rural Health Transformation Program, they're giving $202 million to Ohio, try to combat those hospital closures, try to help with the access to health care in rural areas. It's actually been a bipartisan reaction. Republicans and Democrats in the legislature have said this is not going to be enough in Ohio to be able to sustain what we have in the rural health that we need in Ohio. So they're still looking into it. It was a total of $50 billion that was given over the country. It's spread out over 10 years. So we're looking at this $202 million to last us for a while and then see what happens when the next budget rolls around to see if we can get some Medicaid funds back. And then you have the Affordable Care Act stuff on top of that. It's going to be hard to see how healthcare is going to be impacted, the full picture of how it's going to be impacted, especially in rural areas in Ohio.
We did a show about this Rural Healthcare Transformation Fund when Ohio submitted its application, mm-hmm. basically because, you know, we talked to people who helped Ohio with its application, and they talked about how it was $50 billion over 10 years, and there's 50 states, and obviously every state applied, and it wasn't going to just be that each state gets a billion, because that's not how that works. They were talking about how no matter how this was divided out, it wasn't going to be enough for anyone. But the optics were, it sounded great, $50 billion over 10 years. So right. That was what the give and take there.
Yeah, right. So you have to, you know, you have the full context of things, of how much money we're truly losing, you know, and the state wanted between $181 and $252 million, and they sort of got the middle of the road, $202 million. So
they should be happy.
Right. So you see the optics. But if we're talking about the whole picture of healthcare, it's kind of even the Republican legislators and Democratic legislators, everybody has said it's a drop in the bucket. Mm.
You're listening to the All Sides Weekly Reporter Roundtable on 89.7 NPR News. We are talking with Susan Tebben from the Ohio Capital Journal. We are talking with Shane Stegmiller of Hannah News Service and Karen Kassler with the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. There is a bipartisan bill that's in committee right now that proposes to put chips instead of swipes into the EBT cards, the food stamp cards. This is viewed as a more secure type of payment. It protects against fraud. This sounds like an easy fix. This sounds like something that we could just, like, do we even need a bill to change the cards? But does anyone know what's happening with this bill? Where is it going? And how hard is it to fix these cards to make them more secure?
I think this is something that's been talked about for a while.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of fraud in the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, food stamps. There have been a lot of advocates for SNAP recipients who've said if you did put a chip in there, it could help, that it would be better than, say, photo ID, because quite often you have people who are shopping for those who can't get out to the store who through SNAP. And so if the photo ID, if your photo doesn't match because you're shopping for somebody else, you know, that's going to be a problem. So this has been something that's been talked about. I think there will be a cost attached to it. So that's going to obviously be something that's going to have to be discussed.
Mm. Yeah. We did a show a while ago about food stamps and EBT, and we had, I can't remember the name of the state agency, but Matt Damschroeder was on to talk. Is he in charge of Job and Family Services?
Yes. Family
okay.
Services.
That's who does the cards. And he was saying how much money Ohio loses in fraud and that the chips would fix it. But I truly don't know how hard that would be and I didn't know you needed legislation to make all new cards.
Well, ODJFS says that between June of 2023 and the end of 2024, there were $17 million in SNAP benefits taken from people who are supposed to be receiving them. And a part of the problem is those folks who have those benefits stolen, they don't get those back. And so that is a concern for those folks, as well as this is money that the state had set aside for a certain population and they didn't get it. So, you know, it fuels the conversation about waste, fraud, and abuse, but waste, fraud, and abuse is not, you can't solve government problems by just targeting waste, fraud, and abuse. There are other issues here in terms of the cost of programs, because you do have a significant number of people who are receiving SNAP benefits in Ohio, who are on Medicaid in Ohio. You know, these are significant numbers.
Yeah, that $17 million came from 34,000 different SNAP recipients, according to the Ohio Association of Food Banks. So, I mean, you're already talking about 34,000 who have had active accusations of theft happening to their cards, and then you want to chip every other card. I mean, it's an administrative load that I'm sure takes a lot of money, and there has been legislation to do so. We just haven't seen any movement on it, so I'm not sure if the appropriation of money is the biggest impact.
Oh, okay. Yeah, and maybe the legislation is needed to appropriate the money for this part of this project, yeah.
And I think there's also been concern about stores. Like, for instance, there was this discussion about banning sugary drinks from being able to be purchased with SNAP benefits, that stores that serve people who use SNAP benefit cards, there would have to be some re-education or realignment with their machines or that sort of thing to make sure that that ban could actually go into effect. So it's not as easy as just flipping a switch. There are things that need to be done to make sure that these things go into place.
And you're talking about the loss of federal SNAP funds, which is going to impact how we even are able to give these SNAP funds and be able to, you know, distribute it in the first place.
Before we take a break, I wanted to talk about at a recent U.S. Senate hearing, Senator Husted spoke out against the use of the abortion pill. And Susan, you wrote about this. What are some reasons that Senator Husted gave for him opposing and speaking out against using this drug?
So he gave two big reasons, and this whole committee was to talk about the, quote, dangers of the mifepristone, which is a drug that is used for medication abortions. And the one reason he gave was two reports that we've had, one in Ohio and one in another state that is evading me right now, of men who have unknowingly or unwittingly given their partners or women that they were the mifepristone pill through dunking it in hot cocoa and dissolving it and making them drink it or giving it to them while they were asleep. Those were the two accusations that are being made of these men. So the women didn't know they were taking this pill. So he said that, you know, having more restrictions on this pill would stop that sort of thing. And the other other reason he gave was he was adopted, and he said that his adoptive biological mother had the option to abort him but decided not to, and so effectively he wouldn't be here if that had been a choice. So that's a reason to keep the regulations on this pill.
Was he saying that only women should be able to have access to this pill? Like a man was able to get it through a prescription or something? Is that, do you know?
No, it was mainly the people that, we don't know how these men were able to get this pill, but he's saying that they would not be able to do this, you know, disingenuously if there were more restrictions on that. Whether that's true or not, ask anybody.
Yeah.
Ask the advocates.
Okay. Well, and is there any update on any pending legislation in Ohio related to abortion? I feel like there's constantly bills, right?
Yeah. So we are still getting up and running here as far as bills go. But yeah, we have several bills. One is if people are familiar with the term personhood, that would effectively ban abortion at conception, making an embryo have personal rights through the Constitution. And then we have other bills that are trying to reinsert the 24-hour waiting period before you can have an abortion, which is currently held up in court from a previous try to do that into the law. And then we have several others that are trying to, you know, take away Medicaid funds for abortion clinics that provide abortions, and others that are trying to, you know, set the regulations as to whether you can take these abortion pills and whether they have too much of an adverse side effects to be able to just give these things out without it being an in-person thing. So that's going to impact telehealth as well. So we have lots of different bills floating around.
All right.
And the personhood idea is not a new one. I mean, there was an effort, I think, to put it on the ballot or something like that going back several years. Mm-hmm. So this is an idea that's, what's that again?
Decades.
Yeah. This is an idea that's worked its way back around again. Yeah. Some of these ideas never fully go away. We still talk about them.
Nationally and in the state.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I guess we'll keep an eye on all that legislation if we can. It's a lot there. Yeah. Coming up, we are going to talk about a candidate for attorney general who is drawing some condemnation from fellow Democrats and Republicans for comments he made about President Trump. That is when All Sides and the Reporter Roundtable continues on 89.7 NPR News. You're listening to All Sides and the Weekly Reporter Roundtable. I'm your host, Amy Jarovich. Still with us from the HANA News Service, Shane Stegmiller, Susan Tebben, a reporter for the Ohio Capital Journal, and Karen Kassler, Bureau Chief for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. This Wednesday, February 4th, is the deadline for candidates to officially file to get on the May ballot. You can expect familiar names and some new names to crop up. One familiar name is former Democratic Representative Elliot Forehand, who is running for attorney general. He's drawing some criticism from fellow Democrats and Republicans for some pretty shocking comments he made online about President Trump. Shane, he's a candidate as a Democrat for attorney general. What did he say online?
He's a former state rep, and he posted a video that said that basically, he said, I'm going to kill Donald Trump. And the way he explained it away is he's going to go in as attorney general and he's going to bring a criminal case against the president that he is going to prove in court. And then once he is convicted, he will also seek the death penalty. And therefore, Donald Trump will have to be executed under Ohio laws because he will prosecute a death penalty case against Trump.
Okay. So I that's a lot. So
it is basically, I am going to get a conviction that will lead to a sentence of capital punishment against Donald Trump.
All right. So he's running for attorney general. Who else is in this race?
So the other names on this is currently the state auditor, Keith Faber. He is seeking to kind of laterally move over to the attorney general's office because he's up against term limits. And then Democrats also have John Kolowitz is the attorney general candidate also for the Democrats. He's the one that has the state party backing. He's a well-known attorney around Capitol Square. I don't know how much he's known to the rest of the state. He recently wrote a book talking about his time on Capitol Square and kind of a memoir himself. Both Faber and Kulowitz have kind of come out and distanced themselves from Forehand. Forehand might be kind of seen as a long shot candidate in a way because, he's a Democrat from a very heavily Democratic area up in Cuyahoga County. He was only a one-term state representative. He burned a lot of bridges with both parties. There was a lot of accusations of inappropriate behavior in terms of just kind of berating and yelling at fellow legislators. So he then faced a primary and lost his primary for re-election.
And he's got an ongoing defamation suit going against those
Democrats
and legislative leaders.
So he knows how to make a headline and get his name out there, for better or for worse, I suppose.
And like it's go ahead.
I was going to say, I mean, he's kind of a lone shot candidate. So what better way to get your name out there than posting a video that says, I'm going to kill Donald Trump.
Yeah.
But then explain, well, this is the way I'm going to do it. I'm going to bring a capital case against him and get him convicted, and then we'll apply the death penalty. And here we are on NPR talking about Elliot Forehand. So he's getting his name out there, and maybe he's thinking, you know, if there's certain people who really hate Donald Trump and they hear me say this and it makes sense, maybe I'm going to get a little more traction in my campaign.
And he's doubled down on it. So it's not like he said, oh, wait, I shouldn't have said. No, he's doubled down. I talked to him last week, and he just maintained that's what he meant and that's what he's going to do.
And the Ohio Democratic Party is not endorsed, but they have indicated that because of all this, they may actually consider endorsing before the May primary. So this is something that's gotten the attention of Republicans, certainly. They've brought their criticisms forward about Elliot Forehand and describing him as the Democrat in the race, which is not the case. But then Democrats have also spoken out against him, saying that what he said was awful.
Yeah, and the Democratic chair has also just said political violence is not acceptable. Yeah, and
it's silly season. So, you know, if you're Keith Faber, you know, Forehand makes this outrageous comment, then you're like, if you're him in the Ohio Republican Party, you're going to go, well, what does every Democrat have to say about this? And so every Democrat has to go out of the way and say, okay, yeah, this is obviously not something that should be done.
So I mentioned before we started talking about him that the filing deadline is this week. So what does that mean exactly? That if a candidate wants to be on the ballot, they have to turn in their paperwork by Wednesday. Is that right, Karen?
Yes. And that's for all candidates. And Ohio has a sore loser law, meaning that you can't run in the primary and then lose and then run again as, you know, an independent candidate. You could run as a certified write-in, but you can't, like, if Elliot Forehand loses, he can't run in the fall except as a certified write-in.
Now, I'm going to clarify, though, that this is partisan candidates.
Yeah,
they have
true.
The filing deadline. So if you want to appear on the May primary ballot for Democrats, for Republicans, and actually the Libertarian Party is actually an official party at the moment. So if you want to run as an official Libertarian, you have to file by Wednesday. Independent candidates will have a later filing deadline. It might actually be the primary day that they have to file. I'd have to double check that, but it's usually around that time.
Okay. And so so just as an example, this morning, Dr. Amy Acton, who's running for the Democratic nomination for governor, she filed officially.
Yep.
We all knew she was running. That's no secret.
Now there's pictures of it now. My colleague, Dan Connick, our videographer, and I were there this morning as that happened. So we expect Vivek Ramaswamy, the leading Republican candidate for governor, to file before the deadline, obviously. Still waiting to hear. He has a challenger in Casey Putsch. I'm still waiting to hear whether he has filed or when he's planning on it. But yeah, by Wednesday, we should know who has filed, at least, though it will be, I think, a day or two before all the signatures are validated. We know exactly who has filed and who's going to be on the ballot.
We'll know who's filed. We won't know if they've got enough signatures for probably a week or two.
So the leading candidates for governor are Vivek Ramaswamy for the GOP and Dr. Amy Acton for the Democratic nomination. Both of them spoke last week on what they would emphasize if elected as governor. So first we have here is Ramaswamy, and this audio is from an appearance he made in Toledo last week. It's courtesy of a 17-year-old independent student journalist from Toledo. So let's listen.
To put more money in your pocket, to improve your after-tax take-home pay, to create a regulatory environment that is so attractive and a tax environment that is so attractive here in Ohio that businesses are moving back here, back into Ohio, staying in Ohio, bring in higher paying jobs that allow you to keep more of what you earn.
And then here is Dr. Amy Acton's message. And then I'll have the panel here weigh in on what they're laying out in their agenda.
What we actually need to do is fund the right things. You know, we have the person, you know, my opponent picked to be his running mate was the architect of giving, you know, $600 billion for a Brown stadium when we did not fund what a bipartisan group of business leaders and the governor wanted for our child care, while we're not taking care of the issues for our rural hospitals. We are not funding the things that Ohioans want us to fund.
All right. So what do you make of these two messages? I mean, do you think that what they're saying is going to resonate with Ohioans? This is a months-long campaign. They will face off, you know, after the primaries. We're talking November here. But what are your initial impressions hearing those cuts, Susan?
Pretty unsurprising. I mean, it seems like the role that they were both sort of settled into when they started this race, which with Vivek saying entrepreneurial experience, he's going to, you know, bring this business experience into Ohio and make it work for the state. And then, you know, you have Amy Acton talking about, you know, on the ground, more on the ground things, rural hospitals, things that are outside of, you know, just talking about the economy and just talking about that stuff, talking about things like healthcare and things like, you know, things that we're thinking about on a daily basis, utility bills, things like that, versus just, you know, rising up as a whole in an economic way.
Shane, have you been tracking at all any monies that's been raised, Ramaswamy versus Acton? They've both raised a record amount so far for where we are in the campaign. Do you know where the financial support's coming from and how they're doing?
This Friday was the deadline for everybody to file their what are called their annual reports. That's covering the last 6 months of 2024, 2025.
What year is it? I know. I don't know what day it is. Okay.
I'm so screwed up. Since COVID, you know. So they had to file those. Vivek's shown that he's a pretty proficient fundraiser. He's raised about $20 million just for 2025 alone, and that's without him even spending any of his own money. He's campaigns claiming that is the record for any gubernatorial candidate. But Amy Acton has shown that she's been able to raise a little bit, especially as kind of the field's cleared for her. She raised close to about $4 million in the last period and raised about $5.3 million for the entire year, which is pretty good for a Democratic candidate. I mean, the previous record was Richard Cordray back in 2018. And it costs a lot of money to run a gubernatorial campaign. It's going to probably be $20-$40 million campaign by the time we're all said and done.
Yeah, Karen, are we shaping up to have one of the most expensive governor's races
and
ever?
And Senate. I mean, mm-hmm. That's going to be a very expensive race, and because it's unusual, you've got a senator who has been appointed to the position in John Houston, who's never run. He'll be running against former Senator Sherrod Brown. That's unusual when a former senator tries to return to the chamber, and that's already gotten, you know, some national attention. So those two races are going to be the big ones to watch. But there's a lot of other races on the ballot, too. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be a big year.
We have about 2 minutes left. Is there anything anyone's covering this week that you wanted to preview? Anything big happening? No?
It's going to be a slow week, I think.
It's a slow week.
I think we're still recovering from all the snow.
Where's everybody at? No one's at the State House.
Yeah, legislators just catching up because they had to cancel last week, you know, for the snow. So I think they're still getting their feet under them.
Okay. Yeah. So just seeing who files for the filing deadline. Yes. Shane, are you going to be hanging out at the Secretary of State's office waiting to see if anyone interesting shows up?
I don't know if I'll be hanging out there, but I'll be bugging their comms people, and I'll also be calling around all the boards of elections because I'm kind of a nerd, so I want to know who all is running for the state legislature, too, because it's...
Oh, all those seats. Yeah.
All those seats. Well, you'll have all 99 House districts, and then you'll also have about 16 or 17. It's half of the Senate districts. Mm-hmm. I believe it's this year 17. So, and it's always interesting because there's a name that maybe is a somebody you've heard of before that suddenly they're making a comeback. And it's like, I haven't heard that name in over a decade, but here they are again, back on the ballot.
All right. Well, we'll have you back to find your surprise names.
Yeah. And also all 15 members of Ohio's congressional delegation, two members of the Ohio Supreme Court. The Ohio Supreme Court right now has the only statewide elected Democrat in office. So she's on the ballot this year, Jennifer Bruner. And so, yeah, it's...
And there's a pretty competitive Republican
primary
to try and take her down.
All right. Thank you to Shane Stegmiller from Hannah News Service. Thanks for being here, Shane.
Thank you.
And Susan Tevin, reporter for the Ohio Capital Journal. Thanks, Susan.
Happy to be here.
And Karen Kassler, bureau chief for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Thanks, Karen.
Thanks.
And just for your records, we talked about it at the beginning. Punxsutawney Phil saw his shadow, six more weeks of winter. Buckeye Chuck, the opposite, says we will have an early spring. So we can go with Buckeye Chuck for now. This is the Reporter Roundtable from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube. But what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.